mind-boggling. But also, now let me go just a few lines further. Major Patrick Powers, now this is back in 1962. Major Powers, who was head of the U.S. Army Space Development Program, told the Family Circle magazine that in his opinion, the first men to reach the moon must be prepared to fight for the privilege of landing. And even more surprising, in December of 1962, at the convention of the American Rocket Society here in Los Angeles, the speaker was Dr. Carl Sagan, advisor on extraterrestrial life to the armed forces. Dr. Sagan told his audience that mankind must be prepared to face the probability that we have already been visited by intelligent beings from elsewhere, and that they have or have had bases on the averted side of the moon. Gentlemen, we are at the top of the hour. We have got to take a break. When we come back, more of UFOs Tonight. My name is Don Ecker. This is the Cable Radio Network. And if you've been trying to call in, here's what you do. Area code 818-3.
You saw, Sir Professor Holm.
Yes, my wife Ann and I saw two of them.
Oh.
We were crossing the Mojave Desert late one afternoon coming out toward California, and but my wife called my attention to something that was moving along over a low mountain range that the railroad track was parallel on. And I looked out, and my first thought was that it was a blimp. And we concluded that it was at least 800 feet long.
800 feet long.
I watched it very closely, and it was so close to the mountain that I could get some idea of it. And while we were watching it, as it paced the train, it dropped back, stopped altogether. And then finally...
Just hovering then, huh?
That's right. It finally picked up and came up to where we were again, and proceeded with its pacing tactics. And then suddenly, like a flash, right behind it and below it, a saucer-shaped object appeared.
This is just like the saucer-shaped object
yes,
that we've heard described before.
That we know about. And then I decided if my calculation on the larger one, the long cigar-shaped object, was correct, then the other one was about 100 feet in diameter.
Huh.
The saucer.
About 1/8 the size.
That's right. They followed us along for 2 or 3 minutes more, and then suddenly just whoosh, and they were gone.
Huh.
I couldn't say whether they went over the mountain range or went up. It happened so fast that we had no way of gauging it. We weren't expecting it. There's no question in my mind whether it was metallic and
it had a metallic color to it.
That's right. And it was controlled. There wasn't any question about that because it stopped and hung right and without moving.
Hmm.
An 800 feet long of metal, that's what it must have been, can't hang in the sky on what they call sky hooks and all that.
But you are a man who whose business it has been to observe things in the sky and make deductions as to size, distance, shape, and so forth.
Yes, naturally.
I would think an astronomer would be fairly well qualified to look in the sky.
Major Patrick Powers, long a top man of the Army Space Development Program, said that the first men to the moon must be prepared to fight for the privilege of landing. Dr. Carl Sagan, advisor on extraterrestrial life to the armed services, said in December of 1962 that man must be prepared to face the probability that we have already been visited by beings from elsewhere in the universe, and that these beings have, or have had, bases on the averted side of the moon, from where they could easily see us.
And we are back. There you have it. Did you catch that, Jim?
Yes, sure did. Very, very interesting.
Yes, sir. Let's go to the great state of Vermont. We have Ray calling in on satellite. Good evening, Ray.
Hey, greetings from the People's Socialist Republic of Vermont.
Good evening. Good evening, Ray.
Hey, we got in a little late. We were watching for this comet to hit, and we didn't see a thing. It's kind of overcast here. I was wondering if you knew anything about it. And by the way, kudos to Mr. Schultz. He deserves an Academy Award for that impersonation of
Mr.
Sagan.
Sagan.
And also, Don, when is your TV program going to come about?
Oh, that's a good question, Ray. Who knows?
First of all, let me just tell you, I did hear, it whet my appetite, just as I was leaving to come here to the studio, CNN in Spain, they had quite a sighting of the comet. It was the smallest piece, the first piece to enter, and their description was quite phenomenal. And then they cut to Mr. Shoemaker, who was at a press conference saying that it looked like it was going to be quite a show, that there was a great fireball. And they were hypothesizing about how far the fireball went into the atmosphere, but they were able in Spain to see the glow on the other side of the planet. So it looks like we're going to learn something about atmospherics over the next few weeks here.
That's fantastic.
I hope they publish some film on it. Because
I'm sure they will.
We can't see a blessed thing here.
Well, we are going to, as soon as we leave here tonight, we're going to take my telescope out in the front yard and do a little checking around.
See the neighbor next door. It's really quite...
From what I hear, it won't have any effect on the Earth, but I don't know how they can know that, but that seems to be the general postulation.
No, I think it's basically they are going to study the atmosphere. They want to see if some of the interior atmosphere of the planet is churned up to the surface. So they're...
Would a great number of these nuclear explosions be enough to force the planet Jupiter out of its natural orbit?
No.
Would have a...
No.
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 Well, I guess I can sleep sound tonight.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you figure it like this, Ray. The if we could place the Earth in front of Jupiter, it would take 11 Earths to reach from one side of Jupiter to the other end. Now, the largest chunk of this comet is approximately 1 to 2 kilometers in size. That would be comparable to taking a great big huge apple and hitting it with a pinprick. Now, where the pin enters the apple, it's going to make a heck of a mess, right? But as far as the overall apple, it's not affected. So I wouldn't worry about it.
Well, good. All of us here in the Big Apple of Vermont are all pleased to hear that. And I'll hang up and let all the rest of your callers get a chance.
Okay, Ray. Right. Thank you.
It may have an effect on healthcare, but we'll have to worry about it.
Jim, were you aware of what was being stated 30 years ago by people like Carl Sagan or Major Patrick Powers?
Oh, when I got into this, I went back. It was amazing how many of these old books were still on the library shelves. At least 12, 13 years ago, I'm sure most of them have been decimated by now. But quite a few of Frank Edwards' books were still on the shelves and made for very interesting reading. Carl Sagan actually wrote a very interesting book with a and the name escapes me, with a Russian astronomer, and I want to say this was back in the early 70s, perhaps, and he was quite open to the possibility of life out there, and he seems to have changed quite a bit.
It's interesting, isn't it? Particularly when they, as I say, with astronomers and physicists, that you reach your peak before 30, and it's all downhill after that.
Yeah.
Is that what happened to us?
That is exactly what's happened to us.
Oh, it's going
to
be a while before I say that.
Hey, let me tell you also, just the next page, Edwards had something else very surprising to say. Now, remember, when this particular part of the book was written, was probably, it was right before Edwards died in June of 67. It was probably like late 66, very early 67. And of course, both the United States and the USSR were in the midst of the great space race to the moon. Now, listen to this. This is an observation that Edwards made. To date, Russia has sent two photographic devices close enough to the moon to make and return photographs of reasonable quality. Please note that upon both occasions, the device photographed the averted side of the moon. They did not take a single picture of the near side of the moon. Russia showed no interest in the side of the moon where she hopes to land a man, but devoted all her efforts to filming the averted side where Dr. Carl Sagan, suggested that someone may have already landed.
Unbelievable.
That is totally, totally.
You know, through the years, you forget that quotes are made like that, you know, and it gets buried in the dustbin of history, I guess.
Well, you can't. How do you reconcile the things that he is saying today? That's the problem. I can't reconcile it.
Well, I will tell you that, and I hate to, speak for Carl Sagan, but I will tell you that I've become more of a skeptical inquirer over the last 12, 13 years, only because I've seen this field get so sullied with such nonsense
right.
that it really takes away from the pure research of it all.
Are you talking about, when you say nonsense, are you talking about books like that have been published by Fred Steckling?
Yeah, and even with all due respect to Richard Hoagland, I mean, I guess he's performing a valuable service out there, but I just, in my mind, I do not know how he can postulate some of the things that he does from photographic evidence.
Such as what, Jim?
Oh, just that. First off, how can he even date these objects?
It's
number
true.
One, number two, to postulate what's actually the purpose of these objects or why they're there, and to make some kind of correlation between something he sees on Mars with something he sees on the Moon with something he sees in the Sahara. That brings people like James Oberg out of the woodwork to have a field day. I mean, maybe I'm alone in feeling that, but I don't think you need to complicate these photographs with that much mush.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. While we chew on that mush, we're going to take another commercial break. When we come back, more with my guest joining us from North Carolina, Mr. Jim Sylvan, and my in-studio guest and co-host, Mr. Dwight Schultz. And if you've been trying to call in, this is how you do it. And we are back. And, you know, Jim, I also have here tonight one of my research books I brought in by Major Donald Keyhole. And it was a book that was published in 1955 titled The Flying Saucer Conspiracy. Now, even though it has somewhat of a sensationalistic title, there are some absolutely true gems of research in here that Keyhole was conducting over 40 years ago. And in Chapter 5 of this book, Enigma on the Moon, the title of the chapter, there are a number of... Are you there, Jim?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, there were a number of references that Keyhole was talking about with some astronomers around the world and some science writers were discovering. Let me read this to you. On the night of July 29th, 1953... John J. O'Neill, who was the science editor of the Herald Tribune newspaper, settled himself at his telescope. At 6:30 Universal Time and on the Moon on its northerly course, was approaching the equator when O'Neill made his amazing discovery. Stretching across the Mare Crisium crater was a gigantic bridge. For a moment, O'Neill refused to believe his senses. It might be an optical illusion. He changed his eyepieces. He checked them, rechecked them. And once again, he looked. Stretching in a straight line from pediment to pediment was a bridge apparently approximately 12 miles long. Now, what makes this so interesting is that also, 1 month after O'Neill's discovery, the existence of the bridge was confirmed by the British astronomer Dr. H.P. Wilkins. And Patrick Moore, of course, anybody that knows anything about astronomy knows of all the books that Moore wrote, who was a leading member of the British Astronomical Association, also affirmed this. And then the bridge was gone.
Mind-boggling.
I'll tell you, when I first started working with these photos, I would get the most response out of the photograph of the Sea of Crisis, and I even had amateur astronomers that would send me 35-millimeter photographs that they took from their Earth-based telescope and would circle the area that they had been observing, they said, for years and years, and it would correspond with the same area that was on these photographs. Telling you, the Sea of Crisis is just chock full of anomalies.
Okay, let's go to Chicago. We've got Sean, who's joining us on satellite. Good evening, Sean.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Okay, well, I had a couple questions. Are most of these things, the features on the moon, are they like set in one general area, or are they kind of just scattered all over the place?
No, there are some areas that have a heavier concentration than others. The crater Tycho, King Crater, which we spoke about, the Sea of Crisis, Copernicus. Some of these areas have been watched for years and years, and they seem to correspond with photographs that have the most anomalous objects in them. And again, they are very, very visible with a magnifying glass. You do not need to enhance these.
Okay. Were any of these sites anywhere near where the Apollo crew landed, or?
Some of them were. I will tell you that I always found it interesting that the bulk of photographs that were available, again, were photographs of areas that had over the last couple hundred years had been observed from Earth as having some transient phenomena. That might have been a coincidence. They may have just been mapping the entire moon, but there are probably over a million photographs actually available in the NASA archives right now from the everything from the Ranger series on up through the Apollo series.
Well, you know, the Clementine spacecraft is supposedly had just finished taking about 1.5 million photographs. Now, what in the world, Jim, do you have any idea why our American Department of Defense would want to spend all that money to send a DOD probe up there to re-photograph the moon?
Probably just to make sure that our base up there is still up and working. I don't know. To be real honest with you, I'm a working stiff, so I don't have as much time to devote to this as I did in the past. But that almost went by me without any knowledge that it was even up there. And again, if you're lucky enough to be hooked into the internet, there are some FTP sites that you can actually download some of these pictures, and I believe some of Hoagland's pictures might originate from the Clementine.
And Hoagland was in on this Clementine thing too, Jim. He even had a theory: is the Clementine photographed from an altitude of 400 miles? Hoagland had a theory that, well, based on the previous photographic orbital missions, which were at approximately 70 miles, and the Apollo astronauts photographed from 30 miles. Hoagland is now stating that the reason that this was photographed from 400 miles is because they now know about these structures, which are 60 to 70 miles high. So he's even decided to use this aspect of the Clementine mission to fit into his theory.
Oh, yeah. I see, and that's the problem.
Isn't it insidious?
You just get off on these tangents. I used to, when I was a younger man, I saw conspiracy under every rock, and certainly as I get older, some of those have been confirmed, but it starts to
everything is grist for the mill, and it makes you so suspicious and depressed.
Yeah. I mean, if you spend enough time worrying about conspiracies every day, you haven't lived your life.
Did you hear that, Don?
Yes, I heard that. There was a conspiracy tonight with my dinner.
Please tell them. Tell them about. Go ahead. Tell them what happened tonight.
Well, I ordered a shrimp pasta dish at this restaurant where we all met. And
you got six shrimp and eight tails.
Six shrimp and eight tails.
You had a hungry dishwasher.
Well, the waitress. that's what I asked. I asked the waitress. I said, go in and check the cook and find out if if he got hungry or something. But, okay, well, we've got to move along. Sean, I want to thank you for your call.
I just had one other quick question. I was talking to a few other friends of mine, and they were telling me that there's, ways around encryption. And, if they can do that, then what would stop someone from tuning into the Clementine transmissions and, decoding them themselves, on their computers or whatever?
You do not. I mean, unless you feel that the file transfers that are going on right now are not very have been doctored, you have access to everything that's coming off of Clementine. You do not need a deep throat. You do not need a secret source inside NASA.
They're just sending the computer and a
modem.
Hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Sean.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to have to take another quick break. When we come back, more phone calls. We've got Dave, who's been hanging on from San Diego. We're going to be getting to him, and if you've been trying to call in tonight, here's the number. Okay, we are back, and we're going back to the phones. Let's see, that shrimp is working on me after hearing that music right now, Dwight. We're going to go to David, who's joining us from San Diego on Dimension. Good evening, David.
Oh, good evening. Thank you very much. I appreciate...
Jim, are you there?
I'm right here.
No, I think we just lost our guest.
Oh, we lost Jim.
Yeah. Well, we'll get him back.
Can only support...
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. What were you saying?
I especially appreciated the program, and this is the second one I've listened to, and everyone that's involved. I wanted to reference back to, instead of all the accolades we could share, I think this might be of some interesting nature. Back in the winter, last fall and winter, I had some consultation with Richard Hoagland in reference to trying to get more information relative to doing some documentary work on this, perhaps a television news program.
Uh-huh.
And I gave him some information and then verified it, and then he wanted something a little better, so I got him something much better, and I left messages for him, never heard from him again. We put it out on the net and never heard a word back. And I
was this in reference to the moon, to lunar stuff?
This was in reference to the Observer.
Uh-huh. The Mars Observer.
This was a reference that came, this is a number of my NASA contacts.
Okay.
This NASA contact read as follows. There are two NASA scientists who were close in enough to know of some of the different functionings that were going on regarding the launch and the data from the Observer. Supposedly had made some decision and gone to the BBC and taken the information about the Mars, essentially the entire doctrine that Richard was handing out, how the Mars Observer had been voluntarily shut down and then tampered with, how there was a plan to bring the information back and at a future date in a form that they felt the public could handle. And these scientists who were evidently pretty far up in NASA now found themselves without a job.
Hmm.
And that seemed interesting to me, and I thought it would be interesting to Richard because he could check his sources through the media, through BBC, and find out what was the result of that. And I thought that was very interesting. That came directly from someone inside of NASA who was a ranking scientist, and that came out. That came to me in February.
That's fascinating.
And I would think it would be something that he could track down immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Second, that tells us a lot of interesting things.
If it's true, yes.
Well, I'll tell you what, David.
Is that the kind of thing that has been typical? Okay, yeah, I'm listening.
Okay, I think we have, while we're here, I think we have Jim back. Jim, are you back?
Yeah, sure am.
Okay, like Zach Sitchin told me last year, he said, Don, just keep your fingers off the buttons, you know?
I thought maybe you got mad at me.
No.
It was the shrimp.
Yeah, it had to be the missing shrimp. That's what I'm going to blame it on. David was just relaying some fascinating information there about Richard Hoagland. Was that basically it, David?
Well, I've given him some prior information, which was also very interesting regarding the launch scenario. But Richard had given me a complete readout on everything that he knew, and then I had looked at Stan's work, and I got back to him, and I said, listen, you know, I've got something for you. I mean, I, the hour I got it, I transferred it over to him. Mm-hmm. Never heard from him again, you know. And that was funny because he would call me. We've had a number of conversations, and then suddenly there was silence. And then in tracking this down with people who have known him for years mentioned that in trying to play the game of getting the information and disseminating it, you sometimes end up being like the disinformation network.
Yes.
And so that I just had to accept that that was maybe part of the point, part of the game, that now my information was used in some way, and then I was never acknowledged.
Well, I'll tell you what, David, if you can call me at the beginning of the week at the magazine, I can give you some contact numbers where you can reach him.
Good. That'd
okay.
Be really interesting.
Do you have our phone number?
Yep, I do.
Okay, very good.
It'd be
good.
Very interesting to discuss other things I can't discuss over the air, but why that seemed like that would be a hot thing. And obviously, it would really be interesting to see how the BBC would receive this at some level and then turn it over to NASA.
Okay, very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening.
Okay, we're going to go to Bill, who's calling from Paso Robles. Is that right, Bill?
Paso Robles.
Okay, on Sonic Cable.
This is a little bit perhaps off the subject. I hope not, but I'm the manager of a video store on the central coast of Paso Robles, and being relatively new to this subject, wanted to know if there may be someone could suggest some good videos that I could put out for the general public to rent.
Oh, that's very, very good. One that I would highly recommend would be a recent video release by Mr. George Knapp from Altamira Communications down in Las Vegas, Nevada. Knapp is a television journalist. He put together an absolutely fantastic three-part video series that's just outstanding, and that would be one great place to start. However, at the bottom of the hour, we've got to take a break. Let me put you on hold, put you and my guest both on hold, and when we come back, we will have more of UFOs tonight. My name is Don Ecker. This is the Cable Radio Network. We are at the bottom of the hour. If you've been trying to call in, we've got about 28 minutes for you to get through. Tonight's show, up to this point, has been fascinating. Lunar transient phenomenon. What's really going on the moon? Joining me in studio is Mr. Dwight Schultz, and from North Carolina, Mr. Jim Sylvan. And we will be back after these words.
Baffling lunar anomalies was the gigantic bridge-like structure first reported in the early 1950s by John O'Neill, who described the thing as looking like an enormous bridge with a span at least 12 miles long. O'Neill, who was then the respected science editor of the New York Herald Tribune, received the scornful response he had expected, but it dissipated rapidly when famed British selenologist Dr. H. Percy Wilkins reported seeing the same thing just 1 month after O'Neill's discovery. Shortly afterward, the bridge, or whatever it was, vanished from the Mare Crisium, or at least it vanished from the sight of man.
And you heard it here first. Jim, are you there?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I didn't disconnect you again.
No, I went and got a cup of coffee while I was waiting.
Okay. Bill, are you still there?
Sure am.
Two other videos. UFOs are real. And Mr. Russ Estes, who is a television producer here, just finished, and it's out now, something of a video called Quality of the Messenger. And if you would like some more information on that, and I could put you in touch with Mr. Estes. If you'd like to call me next week at UFO Magazine, that would be another video I would highly recommend for
Okay.
Running.
I want people that, you know, don't hardly know anything about the subject to kind of maybe take it with a grain of salt, but for
absolutely.
Something to start their interest in
yes.
it, too.
Yes,
these
absolutely.
These are legitimate documentaries and tapes. This is not the crass, commercial kind of nonsense. These are legitimate tapes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome, Bill.
Bye.
Let's see. We have Larry, who's been holding from San Luis Obispo on Sonic. Good evening, Larry.
Yes, good evening. Yeah, I was calling to ask about James Olberg. You mentioned him earlier in the program. He had an article in the April 94 issue of Omni magazine mentioning that the UFO flap in Russia of 1967 is explainable as orbiting weapon systems, crescent-shaped craft observed by the astronomers, even from the Caucasus Mountains, that there was just nothing but mistaken observations of nuclear weapons of, you know, orbiting systems. I was wondering if either of the guests could comment on that contention that the 1967 flap is explained wholly by the that explanation.
Jim?
Ooh, boy, you're out of my league there.
Okay. Dwight?
Well, I just want to say I have listened to Mr. Olberg on several occasions, and once in a while he is on the mark, but his dismissal of just about every sighting in the Soviet Union was a disgrace. You can't trust anybody in the Soviet Union. You can't trust anybody anywhere, according to Mr. Olberg. And of course, I have seen Mr. Olberg on the very, very famous Larry King program with Mr. Don Ecker, where Mr. Ecker asked him a very pointed question, and that was, Mr. Olberg, can you actually speak about this subject on your own? And Mr. Olberg had a very hard time. In fact, he would not address that question, whether or not he is working for some other entity other than Mr. Olberg. So that's my comment.
I'll tell you, I've been attacked by Mr. Olberg over the years, you know, many times. I've almost become a little fond of him because
He is kind of round.
I hate to say that, but sometimes he is a skeptical voice that needs to be heard out there. Certainly, I agree with Dwight that it really goes overboard.
There is a point. There are things I mean, I'm skeptical. I really am. And there is a way to be skeptical, and then there is a way to be dismissive.
Right.
Mr. Oberg is dismissive without thinking. I'm starting to lose my taste for Mr. Oberg.
Okay. Well, did that answer your question, Larry?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to Tucson, Arizona. We've got Vince joining us on satellite. Good evening, Vince.
Hello, Don. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How about you?
Good. Welcome to Jim and Dwight. And,
hey, how are you, Vince?
Good. I have some information for everybody, and I also have some questions. I have talked with Richard Hoagland recently and talked with one of the PhDs that works for him, Dr. Bruce Carnett, and have received information on the things that they're doing as far as the moon, and have looked at a lot of the photos. And Tucson, Arizona here has a lunar planter facility that is a regional planter image facility for the lunar data. And all the photos are available, and they're also available in about 16 other places throughout the country. And most of the photos are reproductions that were made when the lunar data came out. About 16 copies were made, so they were made fairly rapidly. And you could easily get bad reproductions, and in one copy you see something and have it disappear in another copy. And just based on looking at the photos, I've seen the images or some of the items that they are talking about, but you really have to blow them up to the point where now you may be blowing up
pixels,
some fuzz that may be on the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen his video that he has made, so I really can't comment on exactly what he's looking at.
What do you feel about his overall thrust, Vince? Do you think that there's something that's viable here? Or do you think it's something that may perhaps have been blown out of proportion?
It's hard to say.
Well, may I just say, he has really gone out on a limb here.
Yes, he has. And I called him up and I said, hey, you know, I'm interested because I was very interested in his Mars investigation.
Yes.
And I would like to see him take more pictures of Mars. But when you go out on a limb to the point where now you're saying there's things on the moon, and if they're not there, that really is going to blow his credibility as far as Mars goes also.
He has gone so far as to say that the structures are made of anhydrous glass, because without water and an airless atmosphere, glass will have the strength of steel, and that titanium has been used in the building of some of these structures. This man is really out there. If he has the goods, we'll find out. But I have to tell you, right now, I am very, very skeptical based on all that I have heard and what little I have seen.
Well, there's definitely some interesting objects, but whether they are really on in the photographs or whether they're an anomaly of the printing process or just an anomaly of watermark or something like that, it's really hard to say.
Okay, let me say this. When we were all growing up back in the 60s, I'm in my mid-40s now. I was in school, in high school, when all these fantastic NASA things were happening. NASA invariably always wore the white hat. Now, one question that has been continuously raised for 30 years, if our astronauts had actually seen anything, why wouldn't they tell us? That's been the question. Our astronauts are the good guys. They're the all-American boys. They eat apple pie, they say the Pledge of Allegiance, the whole nine yards. Wouldn't they tell us if they saw UFOs, if they saw anomalies on the moon? And the question is, no, they would not. Why? Well, to begin with, especially at that time period, they were all military officers. They all would have been under the constraints of a security agreement. Not to mention, least of all, which NASA had absolutely tyrannical control over them. If they would have talked about anything anomalous, they would have faced loss of pay, forfeiture of benefits, possibly fines and jail time. And we are right now going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, more of UFOs tonight. Both you gentlemen on the phone, stand by. I want to come back to you, and we will be back after this.
Quigley, the University of Minnesota's Frank Halstead, and I were discussing astronomical cover-ups, as I said.
I heard about this big effort to get all the information that could be obtained on the planet Mars from this observatory in Johannesburg, or right out of Johannesburg, was it?
Mm-hmm.
And all of this effort went forth, and so many of the world's top astronomers were going to be down there, and this was when Mars was so close to the Earth, I believe, at that time, if I'm not mistaken, about 37 million, wasn't it?
37 million.
Uh-huh. And I never heard any results of it. Did they have something they didn't want to talk about?
Yes. They took 20,000 pictures in various colored silver.
Uh-huh.
But people tried to find out something about them. They clammed up.
Do you know anything about them?
No, not further than I read. I got a National Geographic magazine or something.
It just occurred to me that I never heard anything about that, and I was looking forward to hearing the results of that. Now, what do you think they?
We think they found something there that they didn't want known.
Well, this would mean that there's some sort of a worldwide conspiracy then to hide truth.
That's right. True.
What in the world could there? You say there is, Professor Halstead?
I think there is. Yes.
Do you mind elaborating on that?
In what way?
Any way you care to elaborate?
Yeah, just what do you think?
Well,
I'm curious. I don't think there's any question about what the power that be are withholding information from the people along those lines. Of course, we don't know anything about it, except that we didn't get the information. It wasn't made public. But we do know this, that in regard to the flying saucer, the so-called flying saucer, that's in the same position.
Mm-hmm.
All the other countries have closed down. At first, they were a little bit liberal about it. But now, everybody has the same idea.
All the different countries?
Yes.
Why is it they can get together on a subject like that, but they can't seem to agree on anything else?
Well, of course, we don't know what Russia's doing, or Russia's satellite. But we do know that our Western alliance, that the Western world, we're all working on together. The Air Force in Australia performed the same old story that we had here. That was all a mistake. Mm-hmm. Somebody couldn't see good.
Regardless of the expert.
Right. No matter who it was, that didn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're just getting ready to trim it off and dish it out to us gradually.
And we are back. Okay, Jim, you there?
Yes, sir.
And Vince, you're still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, very good. Did you have any other questions?
Yeah, I do. I have a few more comments. For your listeners, an interesting book that they might pick up is called The Moon and the Planets by William R. Corliss. It's mm-hmm. a catalog of astronomical anomalies. It's called the Sourcebook Project, and it has a lot of things on lunar transient phenomena, not only on the moon, but some of the other planets.
Who is the author again, Vince?
It's William R. Corliss.
Thank you.
And it has some interesting things in there. As far as the lunar image facilities, there is one in Pasadena there at the JPL.
Mm-hmm.
You all, if you wanted to go, I'm sure it's public access. And there's three of them here in Arizona, one at the University of Arizona, and one at Arizona State, and one at Flagstaff at the USGS. So there's quite a few of them around the country that are available for people to go to if they wanted to get to take a look at them. I surely wouldn't order photos and get prints until you've seen them, because it's really hard to see something on the photos, and you may be disappointed in when you're looking at them, because they're a real small fuzzy speck on there. A lot of photos were Hasselblad photos taken, or even some of the orbiter photos, but I mean they're taken from 70 miles or 30 mile altitude, and what you see is a crater that's maybe 26 miles across and takes up about 2 inches of the photo, and it may be 13,000, 20,000 feet high, and you just don't get a good perspective looking at this photo, and you really can't, when you're looking at an object that's...
Have you been researching this, Vince?
I've looked at quite a few of the photos, yes, I have.
Uh-huh.
And there are a few things that are interesting, but you have to know exactly on that photo where to look. Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody told you to go look at photo number, like AS32, you know, the one he's looking at, 4822, I think.
It's 4809 through 22.
Yeah.
Don, can I just say something? That's
please.
Why I've gone ahead and uploaded to America Online the photos that I had that I've actually, the only enhancements I've made have been with arrows and circles, so somebody does have a reference point. If they have that, they've got the photo number, they can go ahead and order the photo themselves, and rather than searching throughout the photograph, they can go right to that point that I've highlighted and see what I see. And I must disagree with you just a little bit, Vince. I've seen enough of these pictures that to the naked eye and with a magnifying glass do show enough detail and do show anomalous figure or artifacts on there.
Do you have some other photo numbers I can go look at?
Sure.
I've looked at the ones that Hoagland's has, and there are some few things that you can barely see on there, but...
But you see, his are blown up so much that there is, like Dwight had said before, there is no reference point. It's you might be looking at fuzz magnified.
Right.
Do you have access to America Online?
Yes, but not really.
Okay. They've got an Omni section, and they've got an antimatter file section, and gosh, I spent all day on Friday uploading photos, so they're, probably by Monday they'll post. Two of those are already on there, King Crater and the Sea of Crisis photo.
Do you have the photo numbers?
Yeah,
I'd
sure
like
do. If you want to hold, I don't want to take up Don's time here. If you, you know, I already gave out the Sea of Crisis number there just a few minutes ago.
That was 728-835. Is that?
Yeah, these are all black. The numbers I'm giving you are for black and white photographs. The King Crater photograph would be from the Apollo 16 mission. The photograph number is 72-H-834. And I'm looking at it right now with a magnifying glass, and I can guarantee you that you do not need to blow these photographs up. I mean, it's quite obvious to the naked eye.
Okay, now these aren't the Hasselblad photos, is that?
Some of these are, yes they are.
Like Apollo 16 photos were labeled like...
Some were taken with a Fairchild camera as well.
Okay, because they all had numbers like 121-16-19.
Yes.
I think we just had... We just had some kind of a breakdown.
Okay.
Did you?
Can you hear me?
I'm wondering what happened here. Something.
You,
something
it?
Went bad
yeah.
here.
Yeah, I guess we're the only ones that can hear each other.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
We've the numbers that I'm giving you are actually from the black and
is
white.
Is it still going out? Okay, it's going out, but nobody is...
Ladies and gentlemen, we are in space. This is what happened when the astronauts were on the other side of the moon.
We had a sudden... There we are. Okay.
Ah, we're back.
I think we're back.
Hello?
Jim, yeah, Jim,
oh,
are you there?
Goodness.
Vince and I were just having a little personal conversation with 15 million people, a larger audience. Vince, I'll just tell you that the numbers that I've given you are the negative, the black and white negative numbers. The numbers that you're speaking of, I believe, are from the actual data tapes, the ASU numbers.
I guess I can probably find out how to cross-reference those.
Yeah. Things. Oh, yeah.
Okay, guys, we are going to have to move along. Vince, I want to thank you for your call. We're going to go to Bert in Burbank, who's joining us on Salmons. Good evening, Bert.
Howdy there, Don. How you guys doing?
Just fine. How about you?
Howdy. I am interested, unfortunately, in not being able to listen to the show. Has anyone spoken about the large, what I call obelisk, but it's much larger than that, that Hoagland showed at the expo here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, we talked about that at the very beginning of the show.
All right, and the reason that I'm calling is, has anybody alerted you guys to the recent article in the Discover magazine, August 94 issue, that seems to support some of Bob Lazar's elemental physics? I'll give you just a little brief thing, and you can read it on page 22, again, Discover Magazine, August 94. Two scientists, one Russian, one American, at Lawrence Livermore, have been doing particle physics and ramming different particles into other particles, and have come up with a very heavy particle that they're determining is element 106. And the interesting thing here is that it has a life of 30 seconds, which is considerably longer than the microseconds that most elements in that area have. And taking that one step further, they're now saying that, and if I can find the little piece down here, by confirming the theoretical predictions of element 106, the Dubna-Livermore discovery increases our confidence in the prediction of heavier elements. The next spherical proton shell at 114 seems that some theorists have predicted that these elements will have lives, half-lives, in the range of billions of years.
Billions and billions,
billions
of years.
And this is exactly what Lazar has been saying for some period of time. I just thought it was curious. Now, and one thing, and I'll leave you with this, there's one more curious thing about this particular experiment, and that is the name of the Russian experimenter is named Lazarev.
That'll work.
Lazarev out of the Institute of Nuclear Research in Dubna. So, good day, gentlemen.
Okay, I want to thank you, Bert.
Thank you.
Let's go to Mary in Simi Valley.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi. I had a quick question for you since we're speaking about science and space. I was wondering if anyone's doing any research on black holes and the fact that they have such a great gravitational pull or magnetic pull that they can suck in enormous objects. And I was wondering if anyone's looking into the fact that this could account for maybe interdimensional space travel or alternate space travel, which is different than the way we rate space and time?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And do you know of anything that's going to be published on that or where I could read about that?
Much has been published. Okay. Read Hawking. Stephen Hawking published a
great deal. Or
really, I'm wondering.
Hyperspace.
Hyperspace by
Michio Kaku. Kaku.
And also Heinz Pegel's... The Cosmic Code.
Cosmic Code?
Yes.
Okay.
But Hawking went to great length in his recent book.
Okay.
Okay, and I've got six people waving at me, telling me I've got to take our last break, Mary. Can you hold on a minute?
Oh, that's okay. That's all I wanted to know. Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
Okay,
bye.
Thank
See
you. Jim, hang on for just one second. We got to take our last break,
okay.
And we'll be back right after this.
Me in talking to Professor Frank Halstead, retired curator of the University of Minnesota's Darling Observatory in Duluth, was the then executive director of the Portland, Oregon Research Associates. I asked Professor Halstead,
What about our friend back at Harvard University? I believe they call him an astrophysicist. Really, he's just sort of an astronomer, isn't he? The one that was hired by the Air Force?
You're referring to Dr. Mendel?
Yes.
Well, I've seen a number of letters from Dr. Mendel that were written to a minister that belonged to the NICAP organization for many years, and to me they were absolutely ridiculous, and his statements were ridiculous, and I never could understand how a man in his way of living and belonging to a great observatory, a great university like the University of Harvard, and supposedly the top man in the astronomical world there, I never could see how he could be so childish and make that silly remark, saying that we were seeing sun dogs and even northern lights and temperature inversions and whatnot. Things were absolutely ridiculous.
Or ball lightning.
Yes.
Professor Halstead, you're quite familiar with such things as temperature inversions and this sort of thing. Why do you think that he takes this line of approach to disclaim all of the reports of reputable people?
Well, I think he's getting something out of this from the Air Force. What that is, I don't know, whether it's I wouldn't say it was money or anything like that, but there's something in the background there to lead a man like that break away from the real truth, which he knows. And I don't know whether you know that or not, but the Air Force itself refused finally to accept his explanation of inversion.
And we are back with my guest joining us from North Carolina, Mr. Jim Sylvan. Jim, we have another call coming in from John in New York on satellite. Let's see what's on John's mind. John, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, guys.
Hi, John.
How
Hi.
You doing?
Love the show. You know, I'm on the East Coast here. You guys keep me up late, or I should say early.
Hey, I'm a soulmate tonight.
You know, I want to point out something about, I guess it was Carl Sagan, when we had the oil well fires over in the Gulf there.
Right.
He had made a prediction that the whole world was really going to suffer from that, and I guess he was proved wrong.
Oh, yes.
That it kind of stayed locally there and didn't, I mean, did some damage, of course, but nothing compared to what he had said. But let me run this one by you. Back in the 50s, and I was looking for the dates, but you had Chuck Yeager, which flew the X-15.
Well, actually, Chuck Yeager was the first human being to break the speed of sound, Mach 1. He broke the sound barrier.
And now, if I'm not mistaken...
In the glamorous Glennis.
Yes, and I thought it was named after his wife.
Yes.
I don't know if you read the book or not.
And he did it with a broken rib.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Gutsy guy, you know what I mean?
There was a guy that was, I guess you have to say, it was luck and skill that he's still alive today.
Absolutely.
For what he did. But if I'm not mistaken, he did receive astronaut wings, did he not?
I honestly don't know.
No, I don't know.
John,
I'm pretty sure in reading the book that he did actually get into, I guess, the beginning of space.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he did that.
Now, if you think about it, if they did that back in the 50s,
you know what that music is? That's my two-minute signal.
Okay, I'll make it real quick.
We're almost out of time.
If he did it back then, and he was almost in space, or we were almost in space at that time, isn't it almost logical to think that we now have a vehicle just like that, or similar, that will get into space on a daily basis?
Well, you'd think we should.
And that
you?
this all this stuff that the you know, you're talking about the shuttle, maybe even Clementine going around the moon, is just a front, that we're out in space all the time. I really can't believe that we haven't advanced. If we were already back that many years ago,
well, it would be hard.
We
it would
doing.
Be hard to believe, John, that our whomever would be behind this would be able to keep something of that magnitude secret from the entire planet. Remember, there are a lot more countries around that are taking a look at the skies than just the United States. But look, we are going to have to cease and desist at this moment. I want to thank you, John, for your call. Please keep tuning in. Jim, we are just about out of time. Once again, the last time we did the show, the program was only an hour. Of course, that wasn't nearly enough time. Now, 2 hours is not enough time.
It goes by very quick.
I guess we're going to have you back.
I'd love to.
Okay.
It's a pleasure meeting you.
Hang on the line for just a minute.
You bet.
And I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Okay, tonight's program, I got to give a special thanks to Mr. Dwight Schultz, who once again has come in and has made this show really happen. And tonight's show would not have happened without Mr. Jeff Floro. Jeff, of course, for the last couple of months have been helping out big time with music, and he's been putting all these sound clips together. Jeff, a big heartfelt thank you. Great job. And next week, we are going to be taking a look at things in our immediate sky vicinity. Hey, Jupiter, it's happening right now, even as we speak. Dwight, you heard some stuff.
Schumacher Levy.
You heard some stuff.
I hope people who have their television sets around the country have been seeing what I heard them discuss from Spain, which was it was going to be a real firework show, that they were very excited that this was going to be phenomenally beautiful.
And that's it. Well, guys, that's it for another week. I want to thank you. Please keep your eyes to the skies. Good Lord willing, we'll be back in a week. And hey, remember, when you're watching the skies, make sure you don't trip over what you ain't looking at.
The shrimp tails.
You got it.